Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks again for listening on this election day. And on this election day, we welcome Mark Halperin and John Heilman, authors of Double Down, Game Change 2012, being released today. This is the sequel to the original Game Change about the 2008 presidential campaign, which was made into that movie with Julianne Moore, Sarah Palin, and all that. The new book is about last year's presidential campaign, but has implications for 2016 with its Chris Christie reporting and more. You may also know John Heilman from his political reporting in New York Magazine and Mark Halperin from Time Magazine. They both also contribute to MSNBC. John, Mark, welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, great to be here. Thank you.
And let's just jump right in on this Chris Christie stuff, since he's almost certainly winning re-election today and is a front runner for 2016. One of the things in the book is his lack of disclosure about his medical history and other things when Romney was vetting him as a possible running mate. What did Chris Christie withhold?
Well, it's a complicated story. You know, most of the time when we have these vice presidential vetting processes, you don't get to really sort of know what happens. John and I did 500 interviews for the book, and we did a fair amount of reporting on this question. Governor Romney, of course, everybody knows at the end, picked Paul Ryan. And Ryan was to some extent his favored choice, maybe even from the beginning. But he was urged to pick Chris Christie by Stuart Stevens, his top political aide, who said at the end of July – or end of June, rather, we're in a street fight. We're losing every day in the media wars. We need somebody added to the ticket who can go out and do what Chris Christie does better than anyone else, be a street brawler, get attention, drive a message against the president. So Governor Romney, who had at that point initially considered Christie, then dropped him from consideration, brought him back in, and they began to try to get him to turn over documents. And in somewhat unusual, maybe even unprecedented, although Governor Christie agreed to participate in the vetting process along with four other potential picks, he was slow to turn documents over, documents regarding his health, documents regarding his brother's financial settlement with the SEC in a civil matter, records about his household help, records about his career as a lobbyist. And these things were eventually not turned over to the satisfaction of the vetters, but there were other documents that were turned over belatedly rather than as soon as possible, which is the way it's standardly done. And the other four gentlemen who were vetted turned their stuff over right away.
I want to play a clip of Mitt Romney, who was asked about this part of your book on Meet the Press on Sunday. And here's what he said.
Well, I know that the vetting people who went through that analysis and put together their report laid everything out. But frankly, there was nothing they found that wasn't already part of the public record and that hadn't already been dealt with effectively by Chris Christie. So there was nothing new there. And with regards to his health, he provided his health records to us. His health is very solid, very good. There's not an issue there.
What were you thinking when you saw Mitt Romney say that on Meet the Press?
We were thinking that Mitt Romney was trying to be nice to Chris Christie and try to protect the confidentiality of the vetting process more than it has been by the people who are sources for us who gave us the vetting report. You know, as Mark points out, you know, we quote the final vetting report at length, something that I don't think anybody's really ever done before in a campaign book. We have paragraph after paragraph of what the vetters gave to Romney and the four areas of concern that Mark pointed out. It is true that Governor Christie provided some medical documentation, but the vetters ended up writing that he had been asked to turn over full medical histories from his most recent physicals and other matter and other medical records that they did not. And they say in their vetting report, you know, this has not been turned over. And if this nomination is to go forward, we need to get these forms in. And literally the day after Governor Romney was presented with that vetting dossier, the final vetting report, was the day that Romney pulled the plug on Christie. It's also true, as Romney says, some of the things that the vetters were troubled by are, strictly speaking, in the public record. For instance, the fact that Christie was a lobbyist for the Securities Industry Association of America during a period of time when that organization was trying to exempt from New Jersey's state consumer protection law financial fraud. At that time, the head of the SIA was Bernie Madoff, So for that is a fact that is in the public record, but the vetters didn't know it. And I would say venture to say that 99% of the people in national politics had no idea that that was true. The vetters saw that fact, again, part of the, quote, public record. But when they learned it, they said, well, that's a 30-second ad waiting to happen in the year, in this climate, with this candidate, Mitt Romney, being attacked for his financial background. We can't have Bernie Madoff's lobbyist on the ticket. So there were a lot of things that were in the, quote, public record that were really problematic as well.
Even though there's no reason to suspect that even if Christie was Bernie Madoff's lobbyist, as you put it, that Christie knew anything at that time about the scam, right?
It's absolutely true. But as you know in politics, Brian, you know, that 30-second ad that says this is the man who lobbied for Bernie Madoff on a matter where financial crime was involved would have been a pretty devastating ad to run, even if Christie could say, well, I didn't know anything about it at the time.
Mark, it's amazing that very little of this came up this year in his reelection campaign. But running for president is a different ballgame. And you characterize his nondisclosure list as, quote, littered with potential landmines. So do you find any of these things a potential threat to Chris Christie in 2016?
Well, there's a gentleman named Rush Schrieffer who worked for both Governor Romney in the presidential campaign and Chris Christie on both his first gubernatorial campaign and this one. And Rush Schrieffer made the case to Governor Romney as Governor Romney started to express concerns about these items and said, look, this stuff's all been adjudicated in the first governor's race. It's all known in New Jersey. And Governor Romney, showing what some might say was unusual political acumen for him, said, totally different. If you're being put on the vice presidential ticket, if you're going to run for president yourself, and also, this stuff's totally different. I think it's an open question how dangerous these would be. A lot of times, look, you look at some of the stuff Bill Clinton survived, and if you just said in a political science course, could someone survive X? Yeah. You'd say, no, that person's out of the race. So it has to do with circumstance and political skill.
What's the most threatening one here, as far as you can ascertain?
I really don't know. You know,
is it health?
Potentially, although he's had surgery since this. You know, he had the lap band surgery, so perhaps that's righted some of this stuff that might have been a concern before. I think one of the things on the list was this investigation done when he was a U.S. attorney. The Inspector General of the Justice Department investigated a handful of U.S. attorneys, and as the report says, found Governor Christie, the way he ran his office regarding travel, staying in fancy hotels, was sort of the biggest violator of the Justice Department rules about travel. That one at the time got a little bit of attention, but the report also said that Governor Christie basically didn't cooperate very much with the investigation, had his assistant answer questions rather than his answering questions. I think there's a lot of unanswered questions on that one. Again, is the offense there so grievous that it would be disqualifying on the face of it? No. But how he handled it in the heat of the moment, either on a vice presidential ticket or running himself, I think is potentially would tell the tale of which one would be the hardest to deal with.
And I'll say, Brian, I think, you know, for Romney, it's the same. The part of the answer here is that for Governor Romney, it was the cumulative effect of looking at this laundry list of things, all of which, any one of which might not have been disqualifying, but all taken together was like there's just a lot of stuff we don't know the answers to and could be surprises. And Governor Christie in the last couple of days asked about this, has said something that's really true, which is he has said a couple of times obliquely, this has been looked at in the past and it will be looked at again in the future. If he runs for office in 2016, I think what this mainly tells you is that people on the national scene do not know that much about Governor Christie. And we are going to, if he wins as we expect him to win today, and he then decides to run in 2016 as we expect him to run, there is going to be a whole new process of
getting to know him in New Hampshire.
And in the pages of national newspapers that have not looked very carefully at this stuff so far.
One more from that list before we move on to some other things from the book. Not disclosing the names and documentation of his household help to the Romney campaign vetters. How serious would it be if Chris Christie has an illegal nanny problem or something like that?
Again, you just don't know. You would have said at one time, could someone who admitted to smoking marijuana be elected president? At one time in our history, not so long ago, you would have said absolutely not.
Depends if they inhaled, right?
Exactly. That's one of the standards. Well, look, we just elected a guy president 5 years ago who admitted using cocaine. If you had said 10 years ago, is that ever going to happen? You'd say not anytime soon, and we did. So I don't think there's anything on the face of it disqualifying, but it does show, to some extent, the desperation of the Republican Party in 2012, when a lot of these very rich donors, as we write in Double Down, tried to lure Christie into the race. I guarantee you these donors don't know a thing about this stuff, and yet here they were on bended knee saying, please get in the race in the fall of 2011, in the summer of 2011. And then If he runs in 16, again, a lot of people who are touting him now as the front runner, he has enormous strengths as a politician. And on paper, if you take his strengths, he's just what the Republican Party needs, head and shoulders above almost anyone else. But these liabilities will be looked at. And as I say, it's probably just as important how he'd handle these liabilities in talking about them and dealing with inquiries as it is what the underlying infractions or problems might be.
Mark Halperin and John Heilman, authors of Double Down, Game Change 2012. And we can take some phone calls for John and Mark. Maybe you've been seeing them on some other media over the last few days or hearing them as this book is being released today. Anything you want to ask, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We can take a few phone calls before we get back to our informal, unofficial, thoroughly unscientific Election Day exit poll for New York and New Jersey voters. But you also write about conflicts between Christie and Team Romney over Christie's Republican convention keynote speech.
Yes.
What did they clash over there?
Well, you know, Governor Romney chose Governor Christie after having decided not to put him on the ticket, made him his keynote speaker in Tampa. And Governor Christie gave a speech that was supposed to be his big first debut on the national stage. A lot of people were comparing it to before he gave it, to Barack Obama's speech at the Democratic Convention in 2004. And he largely, in the eyes at least of the political media, he sort of bombed. People thought that he spoke he talked about himself. He talked about New Jersey. He talked about his family. He talked about almost everything except for Mitt Romney. And he didn't talk very much even about President Obama. It was neither an attack dog nor a big booster of Governor Romney. So there was, in the immediate aftermath of that, there was a lot of criticism that was made. Some of it on background with anonymous Romney aides kind of criticizing Governor Christie. And the next day in the press, Governor Christie was outraged by that. And his attitude was, I showed you this speech in advance. If you wanted me to do something different, you should have had me do something different. And this led to an extraordinary outburst where he was enraged over the course of a few days in Tampa, including one public scene that we report in the book where he went completely ballistic on one of Romney's closest confidants in a public hallway within the Tampa Convention Center.
Maybe he's just a better communicator berating public school teachers on YouTube than he is speaking from a podium. But about whether the speech was vetted, if they were angry at Christie for the content of that speech, was it not vetted? Because I was thinking of that in connection with the Clint Eastwood debacle. Like, didn't they know what they were getting with Clint Eastwood? Didn't they know what they were getting with Chris Christie? Was there a pattern of failure here?
Every indication is they knew exactly what they were getting with Chris Christie. They had reviewed the speech. The aide I mentioned earlier that shared between Governor Romney and Governor Christie, Rush Schrieffer, had seen the speech, and they had some mild disagreement with him on one point, and they dropped it. So I think part of why Governor Christie was so incensed, as we understand it, is because he said, you guys, as John suggested, you guys approved this speech, so why am I now reading in the paper that there's some unhappiness with it? The Clint Eastwood story is a totally different one, and one of the things we're proud about in the book is to go back and reconstruct these scenes, which in the moment, right, anyone interested in the election for 24, 48 hours wanted to know, boy, how did that happen? How did Clint Eastwood get up on the stage with no script and give this rambling odds monologue in which he talked to an empty stool? How did that happen? Because in conventions these days, the sort of conventional wisdom is they're tightly scripted. There's no spontaneity. Every minute is staged. And this was the final night of the convention when Mitt Romney's giving his big speech, which people saw as very high stakes, a chance, his last best chance in an unfiltered way to introduce himself to the country. And he gets overshadowed by Clint Eastwood, who Governor Romney basically decided should come to the convention. And then his aides trusted Clint Eastwood when he said, I don't need a script. You don't need to see my speech in advance. I don't need anything in the teleprompter. I'm going to give the speech. And I'll just say quickly to give a taste of the story, Eastwood decides after listening to a Neil Diamond song about someone talking to a chair, and after deciding and listening to the speeches leading up to his, that everybody's saying nice things about Mitt Romney, he didn't want to be part of that crowd, a sort of parade of people just saying Mitt Romney is the greatest guy ever, decides at the very last minute to ask for the stool to be put out on the set.
To do some performance art.
Some performance art. We like to call it da-da dinner theater, in a way that clearly was bad for the convention.
And I guess you figure if it's Clint Eastwood, who not only acts in movies but makes movies,
right,
if there's someone you can have faith in to be an effective communicator, it's Clint Eastwood.
That's what they thought. And it was a huge miscalculation.
Do you see Christie as a moderate in Republican primary terms? He is as some of our Buono callers have been saying this morning, a union hostile, millionaire tax friendly, low tax guy who did everything he could to stop gay marriage in his state. and with a tough guy persona who didn't sign up for an Obamacare exchange. What would people use to portray him as a rhino?
Well, I mean, look, as Mark pointed out before, he said that Chris Christie has a lot of political strengths. And one of the things that you see, and if you look at Double Down, is this incredible tension over 2012. There's no one who emerges. Mitt Romney is no one's choice, right? He's the choice neither of the Tea Party, nor is he the choice of the Republican establishment. And that kind of comes through over and over in the book. The thing about Chris Christie is that he conceivably is a unifying fusion candidate, right? He has a lot of credibility for the reasons you just said, Brian, with people who are the spirit of the Tea Party and concerned with some of the issues that the Tea Party is concerned with in terms of spending, in terms of unions and things like that. He's also the candidate of the billionaires class and a lot of the Republican establishment. What I think some people will use to portray him as a rhino is, well, for one thing, wrapping his arms around Barack Obama in the course of the Sandy hit and the cleanup efforts there.
But that's just a hug. It's not a policy.
Well, it's not, although it was taken among many people on the base as being a sign of incredible disloyalty to the party at a time when they thought the election was still winnable. Whether or not it was is a separate issue. But there's also the fact that, you know, he's decided to allow there to be, to work with the federal government on things like the implementation of the ACA in New Jersey, which a lot of governors across the country, Republican governors, have said, no, we're not going to accept basically resist the state exchanges. Christie has been what I think no one can portray him as a Ted Cruz standing athwart history and yelling stop. What Christie wants to portray himself as is very conservative, but also someone who's worked with the Democratic legislature and has been pragmatic and being able to get things done. Not an apocalyptic conservative of the kind of Ted Cruz. And for some number of people in the Republican electorate, that kind of conservative, the Ted Cruz kind, is a lot more appealing than the Chris Christie kind.
John Heilman, and if you can't tell them apart, John was just talking, and Mark Halperin, co-authors of Double Down, Game Change 2012, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, and Tony in Fort Lee wants to talk about that list of questions that Christie didn't answer. Right, Tony?
Good morning. Yes, thank you, Brian, John, Mark. And by the way, I'm a WNYC sustainer, registered Republican and an elected official here, not in Fort Lee, but that's where I work. Anyways,
thank you for your support. Anyway, go ahead.
Come on, you guys are great. But I'm sure the book has its points and is valid. But it takes the stance, from what I can make of it as of right now, that judging Christie as it's in a vacuum. Well, of course he has skeletons, and what politician or human doesn't? And that's presuming that he's not going to run against anyone. He's going to run against a Democrat who has equal amount, probably, or maybe more, skeletons in their closet. So it's almost a moot point that, as I see it, he's going to throw the fire as much as he receives the fire from whoever he's going to go up against.
And run against Republicans in the primary first. But, Mark, I think that's the point that you were making. It's not necessarily so much what's there as how he handles what's there, unless there's something bigger there than we know about.
Right. You know, look, he as I said before, he's a talented guy, and a lot of people in New Jersey look at him as a great talent. And governors have done pretty well as presidential candidates. He's never run outside New Jersey. He's never run for president, obviously. And as confident as a person he is, we've seen this movie before, where somebody who thinks they know everything about politics and feel like, hey, I got elected as a Republican in a blue state, of course I'm going to be a strong presidential candidate. I don't see a stronger candidate right now in the party, but I still wouldn't bet a lot of money that he'd somehow magically on his first try figure the whole thing out.
Tony, thank you for your call. How much do you see a parallel with Rudy Giuliani? Similar personality in a way, Republican prosecutor turned mayor in obviously a blue state, blue city. Turns to the national stage and bombs.
Well, there are certain obvious parallels in terms of temperament and in terms of where their political strengths are. There are some elements of contrast too. But I'll say the thing that I think that's most instructive about that parallel is that one of the things we learned with Rudy Giuliani's candidacy in 2008 was it wasn't clear what his path was to the Republican nomination. What was the state that Rudy Giuliani was going to win? They looked at the national. At the Republican primary calendar, and they said, well, Rudy Giuliani can't win in Iowa. He can't win in South Carolina, these heavily evangelical states. Is he going to be able to win in New Hampshire? That's another question. They didn't really find a pathway towards the nomination. Chris Christie, when he looked, as we report in the book, when he looked much harder at the notion of running in 2012 than people think, you know, one of the things that his advisors had was they had the same question that Rudy Giuliani's advisors had, which was, what is the plausible pathway here? Is he a good Iowa candidate? Probably not. Is he a good South Carolina candidate? Probably not. So essentially you're saying, you know, he's going to have to win New Hampshire and then parlay that into a strong showing in Florida. It's not undoable, certainly, but it's also not the automatic kind of pathway that a lot of Republicans have found their way towards the nomination in the past.
I don't know if you deal with this in the book, but for all the talk of how right-wing you need to be to get through the Republican primaries, the moderate won the nomination in both game-change cycles, Romney and McCain. What do you make of it?
Well, I mean, look, if you look at the history of the recent Republican Party history, you could argue after President Reagan, Republicans have nominated a more moderate candidate every time. Bush, 41, was moderate compared to a lot of people in the field. Same with Dole. Same with, as you said, McCain and Bush, 43. So the party may be being remade before our eyes. The advent of the Tea Party, the populist movements, the strength of Ron and Rand Paul, it may be that we will see a change in 2016. But so far, until that cycle's broken, you got to assume that someone like a Jeb Bush, a Paul Ryan, or a Chris Christie have a better shot at the nomination than some of the people who are not as close to the establishment wing of the party.
We'll get one more Christie call in here. Danny in Lambertville, you're on WNYC. Hi, Danny.
Hi, how you guys doing? Listen, the interesting that you brought up Giuliani, because that's pretty much what I was thinking. We keep hearing about people saying, oh, well, you know, he's popular with New Jerseyans and all this kind of stuff. You know, I'm from New Jersey. Personally, I don't like his personality. I think that would probably be the very thing that would undo him because, as I was saying to your screener, I actually remember this news clip where he was talking to one of his constituents and on camera called her stupid. Now, some New Jerseyans may like that kind of attitude, but I think the broader country, that they're not going to put up with that kind of, you know, I mean, all they would have to do is put a commercial on and lift that clip and say, would you want this man to be your president?
Maybe in the general election. But in the Republican, if we, you know, look at the field from last year, John, he would have been running against a Michelle Bachmann, a Rick Perry. These are not exactly shrinking violets.
They're not shrinking violets, although I guarantee you that, you know, they do not have, as the caller mentions, you know, Chris Christie has got an incredible YouTube collection, right? And those things have made him a darling with the national press because we love that, you know, the colorfulness of it. And again, for some New Jerseyites, that's it's shown his authenticity. But one of the things that Governor Romney looked at was among the things that were given to him in the vetting process that we report about in Double Down is they showed him video of Christie, one particular video clip of Christie angrily chasing a constituent down the boardwalk, like with an ice cream cone in his hand. And there were many Romney advisors at a senior level who looked at that and thought, how will that play? And exactly the way the caller suggested, is that the kind of, does that look presidential? Does that seem too hostile? Does that seem like he's out of control? There will be questions of that kind that go to temperament that will be raised by his rivals and by the press on the basis of the video archive.
Would there be any reason for a Hillary Clinton or whoever it would be in 2016 not to release a commercial that shows Chris Christie running down the boardwalk, chasing somebody with an ice cream or whatever the thing is that's, you know, easy to mock? Is there any reason that we should not expect to see that commercial by a Democrat if Chris Christie is a nominee?
Well, you'd probably maybe see it by an independent expenditure group. I'm not sure a candidate. You know, I mean, is it presidential? Is it focused on the issues? No. And you saw John Corzine, for instance, as he was fighting to keep his job when Christie was running against him the first time. And Christie won after Corzine ran an ad that was showed Chris Christie's kind of at his fattest getting in or out of a car, I believe. And that didn't seem to work. Maybe it had some effect, but it certainly didn't change the race. I think one of the things that Democrats may look back and regret is the failure to, with a weak nominee running against Christie, a failure to do any damage to Christie in the context of this race. He's going to win a decent percentage. Some people may say it doesn't meet expectations.
Does the margin matter today, either for him or de Blasio, for anything?
I think it doesn't matter for either of them, really. There'll be a lot made of it because that's what some people do. But I think they've not done any damage to Chris Christie. Now, his record in New Jersey is mixed. It's not quite the New Jersey miracle that the governor himself sometimes paints it as, particularly with a stubbornly high unemployment rate, although they've obviously had to deal with Sandy. But I think that he comes out of this, whatever the percentage he gets, without the Democratic Party having done any damage to his storyline that he likes to project, which is, I'm a can-do guy who cares about results and can work with people in the other party.
Interesting. Last question. John Hyland, since you also write for New York Magazine, how about this New York City mayoral election? De Blasio as an unabashed liberal after 12 years of centrist Bloomberg. My question is New York City its own political country, or does de Blasio's likely election fit in with anything going on nationwide?
Well, there's no doubt. Look, that in the same way as the Republican Party is being there are new forces that are at large there. The Democratic Party is the importance of progressivism and progressive activists in the Democratic Party now, for a variety of reasons, is having a little bit of a renaissance. And so,
you report in the book how Obama wanted to govern as more of an explicit liberal in this second term.
Yes, although he didn't run that way, particularly in the course of the campaign in 2012 that we report about either. But look. I mean, Bill de Blasio will be a poster child for a certain kind of progressive politics, and a lot of people will seize on him. Whether that brand of progressive politics would actually be successful in very many other big cities in America, I'm not so sure. I don't think that there's Rahm Emanuel is suddenly going to become more of a full-throated progressive than – I mean, Rahm Emanuel is plenty a good Democrat, but not a Bill de Blasio liberal. And I'm not sure you get elected in Los Angeles campaigning the way that Bill de Blasio has either. So to some extent, love it as we do, New York is not America.
John Hyland.
And thank God for that.
Who probably will keep his job as national affairs correspondent for New York Magazine, even after saying that. And Mark Halperin from Time Magazine. Together they have written Double Down, Game Change 2012. Thank you so much. Happy Election Day.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.